Shake their hands and thank them, mentioning their names as you do so. The first year my class was invited to the White House, the President and Mrs. Clinton took the time to shake the hands of each student and parent who was on the trip. I noticed that Mrs. Clinton was doing a very good job of remembering each student's name, and as we were leaving and she was telling the students goodbye, she was calling each child by name. I was really impressed by that, but it didn't end there. 2 years later, I was at the White House with a different group of students, and again, we talked to Mrs. Clinton. Not only did she once again do a great job of remembering each child's name quickly, she also asked me how some of my former students were doing, and she was asking about them by name. Now, I am sure part of this is due to the fact that Mrs. Clinton has an incredible memory, but I also noticed something that she does. When she is introduced to someone, she always replies to them and ends her statement by saying their name. This reinforces in her memory the name of the person and helps her to remember it. I started to teach my kids to do the same thing. People respect you more when you refer to them by their name, and not remembering someone's name can cause an awkward moment. This rule is all about avoiding that situation and using the person's name as quickly as you can after learning it so that you won't forget it. As a side note to Rule 33, if we are on a field trip and I introduce you to someone while you are sitting down, you must stand up to shake the person's hand. It is very rude to remain seated when being introduced to someone. Rule 34. Whenever you are offered food, whether it be on a buffet or treats in class, never take more than your fair share. You never want to be greedy and try to get more than you should, not only because it is wasteful, but also because it is disrespectful to others when you do not leave enough for them. Rule 35. Whether we are in school or on a field trip, if someone drops something, pick it up and hand it back to them. Even if they are closer to the object, it is polite to make the gesture of bending down to retrieve the item. In the classroom, it used to drive me crazy when a student's pencil would roll off of a desk and no one would pick it up. The kid would have to get up and walk around to get the pencil. Everyone else would just ignore it. After pointing out to kids how I expected them to pick up anything someone else dropped, they did it and didn't have a problem with it. After a while, it really became commonplace to them. Rule 36. If you approach a door and someone is following you, hold the door. If the door opens by pulling, pull it open, stand to the side, and allow the other person to pass through first. Then you can walk through. If the door opens by pushing, hold the door after you pass through. After a few weeks of seeing kids try to cram through doors in the school and watching them enter restaurants as the door slammed on other customers, I knew I had to address this issue with my students. Teaching them small acts of kindness, such as letting someone else go through a door first as they hold it open, may seem insignificant, but it can go a long way toward helping students realize how to respect and appreciate others. Rule 37. If someone bumps into you, even if it was not your fault, say, "Excuse me." Often in school, a gentle bump can lead to World War III. It is all about heading that situation off before it happens. When I first told some of my students this rule, I didn't know how it would work. But after a month of practice and reminding them, I had huge boys bigger than me saying "excuse me" right and left. Sometimes all it takes is explaining to kids exactly what you expect from them. Rule 38. When we are on a field trip, there will be no talking as we enter a building. We will enter the building so quietly that no one will even notice that we are there. This rule applies to entering any place where people are gathered, whether it be the movies, a church, a theater, or any other venue. Rule 39. If we are on a field trip, it is a good idea to compliment something about the place where we are visiting. For example, if we visit someone's home, it would be a nice gesture to tell them that you think they have nice curtains. People are always self-conscious when they have guests visit their home. so you want to make them feel at ease. Also, if we are visiting other places, such as a museum or theater, it would be nice to comment on how beautiful the architecture is or to tell the guide that you think the facility is really nice. Rule number 40. During an assembly, do not speak and do not look around and try to get the attention of your friends in other classes. We must uphold an image that shows we have our act together. And this is another rule that we practice quite a bit. On the first day of school, I line the students up, we march to the empty auditorium, and we sit there, and I show the students exactly where I want them to sit, how I want them to sit, how I want them to hold themselves, and how I want them to act during a presentation or a speech or no matter what's going on stage. I tell the students that they might not realize it, but whoever's on stage can see them very clearly. And if they're sitting straight up, looking on stage, and paying attention, that is respectful, and the person on stage will appreciate that. But if they are slouching down, talking to a neighbor, or not paying attention, that is disrespectful, and that is also noticed by the person who is on stage. Rule 41. When you answer the phone at your house, you must do so in an appropriate manner. Kids, unless they are taught otherwise, have the worst phone manners imaginable. I can't tell you how many times I have called my students' homes and heard them answer the phone by saying, uh-huh, or yeah. When I ask for their parents, the usual response is, who's this? When I say who I am, they become very quiet, but then they yell at the top of their lungs, Ma, the teacher is on the phone for you! I make sure to tell my kids the appropriate way to answer the telephone. I tell them to use the following steps. First, say, hello, or hello, this is the Clark residence. Second, the caller will ask if someone is there, and you should say, yes, she is, may I ask who's calling? Third, tell the person, hold on please, and I'll get her. Fourth, place the phone on mute or cover the receiver with your hand, and tell your family member that he or she has a phone call, and then tell them who was calling. If the person is not home, I tell the kids to make sure they have pen and paper by the phone. The conversation should go like this. First, say, hello, or hello, this is the Clark residence. Second, the caller will ask if someone is there, and you should say, no, I'm sorry, she's not. Would you like to leave a message? Third, if the caller doesn't want to leave a message, you can say, okay, she should be back in a couple of hours. Maybe you should try back then. If the caller does want to leave a message, say, okay, can I get your name and number? Make sure you repeat the number to the person so they will know you really copied it down and to make sure you have copied it down correctly. When you are finished, say, I will make sure she gets this as soon as she gets in. Goodbye. Rule 42. When we return from a trip, you will shake my hand as well as the hands of every chaperone. You will thank us for taking the time to take you on the trip, and you will let us know that you appreciate having the opportunity to go. I'm not concerned with being thanked. I am concerned with teaching you that it is appropriate to show appreciation when someone has gone out of his or her way to help you. Rule 43. When we are on field trips and we have to go up escalators, we will stand to the right. That will give other individuals who are in a hurry the option of walking up the left-hand side of the escalator. When we are going to enter an elevator, the subway, or a doorway, we will wait for others to exit before we enter. Rule 44. When in a line, walk single file, 2 to 3 feet behind the person in front of you with your arms at your sides. You should face forward at all times. There will be absolutely no talking. The first day I started teaching in North Carolina, I knew the other teachers and the principal were curious to see how disruptive the class would be under my inexperienced guidance. The principal had warned me how disruptive and unruly the class was, and I had seen them chaotically walk down the hall to the lunchroom the day before. I knew that when they walked down the hall under my supervision, I had to prove that I could handle the class. I had to have them in a perfect line. As we started to line up, The students were all over the place, talking and laughing and nowhere near organized. I had to do something, so I told them that we would not go to lunch until the line was perfectly straight and no one was talking. I soon realized we were going to be there quite a while, as none of the kids gave much weight to my threat. I told them that for every word someone spoke, we were going to wait 1 complete minute before leaving for lunch. A girl said, "Do what?" And I said, "That would be 2 extra minutes." Someone yelled, "Y'all better shut up because I'm hungry." And I said, "Okay, 7 extra minutes, and be glad I didn't count the contractions as 2 words. After about 30 minutes of this, Mrs. Briley, the head lunchroom lady, came down the hall looking for us. She was quite insistent on sticking to the schedule, and she must have thought I had lost my mind. I stuck to my guns, though, and we finally marched down the hall to lunch, 45 minutes late. I walked at the front of the class, turned backward so I could watch the entire class as we went down the hall. Not a single child in the line was making a sound, and as we passed the office, I saw the kids were looking fixedly on something behind me. I couldn't turn around, though, so I had to wait to finally see that they were looking at the principal, who was standing in the office doorway with a dumbfounded expression. Ever since that day, I have always made sure my classes maintained order inside and outside of the classroom. Rule 45. Never cut line. If someone cuts in front of you, do not say or do anything about it. Let it happen. But let me know about it. I will handle the situation. If you fuss with someone who was cut in line, you could get in trouble as well. It's not worth it. Just let me know what happened. Please handle all disputes with other classmates in the same manner, by coming to me with any problems before you take matters into your own hands. I noticed in my first few years of teaching that the kids who seemed to get in the most trouble were the ones fussing with another student who was actually the one who had done something wrong. For example, James may cut Joe in line, but Joe will start to fuss about it and cause a lot of commotion. Joe will usually be angry and loud, and he is the one who will get my attention and the one who will get in trouble. I wanted to find a way to avoid kids taking matters into their own hands in an inappropriate manner. I started telling the students to come to me with the problem and that I would handle it quietly. I told them that if they fuss or argue, their punishment is going to be worse than that of the person who actually did something wrong. I know you may be thinking that it isn't always best for the students to rely on adults at all times to settle their problems, that kids should learn to handle disputes among themselves, but here is my rationale. Basically, the students know they can't fuss with another student for doing something to them because I am going to punish them even more than the person who did something wrong. Therefore, the students who would normally take matters into their own hands have only 2 options. First, they can come to me with the problem. You may think that this would be the most common reaction, but in actuality, it isn't. Most kids take the 2nd option, which is they can handle the matter themselves quietly, without being loud or fussing. They know they have to be quiet about it, or I will punish them as well for not handling the situation in an appropriate manner. So they learn to handle matters in a more mature and orderly fashion. Rule 46. When we go to a movie theater, there will be no talking whatsoever. I don't care how good the movie is or what you want to say to the person beside you, you will not so much as whisper. You will not put your feet on the chair in front of you. If you are going to eat during a movie, you need to eat as quietly as possible. If you purchase candy to eat during the movie, open the wrapper and have it ready before the movie begins. Trying to open a bag of candy during a movie is very annoying to others. It is also very rude to leave a cell phone or beeper on during a movie. Rule 47. Do not bring Doritos into the school building. This is by far the most talked about rule, and I definitely get more comments and questions about this one than any other. First, I will tell you how I explain this rule to my students then I will tell you the truth about this rule. I tell the students a true story about something that happened when I was young. My mother would buy one bag of Doritos for my sister and me to share as our after-school snack as we watched the Flintstones. My sister, Tassie, being greedy, would take out one chip, lick all of the cheese off it, and then place it back in the bag. She knew I would never stick my hand in the bag after that, so she would have it all to herself. As I recount the story, I play up the effects it had on me, and I tell my students that to this day, I cannot bear to see the sight of a Doritos chip. The truth? Not really. Basically, I just wanted to have a rule that would add character and humor to the list. The little touch of personality adds something unique and quirky to the rules, and the students love it. One teacher, one time, she took my 55 rules from me before I put them into a book form. They're just in a little pamphlet. And she said, "Oh, Mr. Clark, I love these rules and I'm going to use them with my class." And so she went and she was using them for about 6 weeks. And then she came to visit and she said, "Ron, let me tell you, I'm using all of these rules with my students, but there's one rule we just don't understand. That Dorito rule. I mean, I'm not eating Doritos anymore. None of them are eating Doritos, but we don't understand why we're not supposed to." And I just laughed so hard, and I explained to her the true meaning behind the rule. And I told her, I said, "These are 55 rules that fit for me, my tolerance of students, what I expect of students, and how I want my classroom to be. You have to find your own 55 rules. If you want to take some of mine that you really like, great. But don't use a rule just because it's in here. Make sure that it means something to you and that you really have a passion for that rule and want to get something across to your students." Rule 48. If any child in this school is bothering you, let me know. I am your teacher, and I'm here to look after you and protect you. I am not going to let anyone in this school bully you or make you feel uncomfortable. In return, I ask that you not take matters into your own hands. Let me deal with the student. This is a big rule for building morale and a family bond in the class. I want the kids to feel safe in the school, and I want them to see me as someone who will fight for them and stand up for them if the time comes. Some might say, "Mr. Clark, you should let kids fight their own battles." In response, I'd say that I feel the kids have enough battles to deal with these days, and if I step in and handle a few of them, so what? I know if I were a kid in school, it would be nice to know I had someone there to take up for me if anyone messed with me. Rule 49. Stand up for what you believe in. You shouldn't take no for an answer if your heart and mind are leading you in a direction that you feel strongly about. I cannot tell you the number of times in my life that I have wanted to do something, but everyone around me was skeptical and telling me I shouldn't. I guess one of the main times was when I wanted to move to New York City and teach in Harlem, but my parents and friends were all telling me that it was too risky. When I told my co-teacher, Barbara Jones, in Aurora, North Carolina, that I was thinking of moving to Harlem to teach, she said, "You're crazy, Mr. Clark." I mean, that was pretty much the sentiment that everyone shared. No one could believe why I was going to do that. But I had a strong feeling that it was what I was supposed to do. So I went with it, and it ended up being the best decision I could have ever made. I want my students to have that same type of determination and conviction. If they want to do something or if they feel strongly about a cause, I want them to have the courage to stand up for their beliefs with confidence and fight for what they want. Rule number 50. Be positive and enjoy life. Some things just aren't worth getting upset over. Keep everything in perspective and focus on the good in your life. I love my parents. They are such wonderful and wise people. Whenever I have a problem or if something goes wrong, they have a magical way of showing me that it's never as bad as it seems. They have always said, "Well, Ron, these things happen. There's no need to get upset about it. We'll work through it." I cannot tell you how comforting it is to hear that. One of the main reasons I love my parents so much is because of the way they view the world. With tolerance, understanding, and acceptance of all the world has to offer, good and bad. They are such positive people, even in the midst of adversity, and I have tried so hard to adopt that quality myself and to pass it along to my students. Rule 51. Live so that you will never have regrets. If there is something you want to do, do it. Never let fear, doubt, or other obstacles stand in your way. If there is something you want, fight for it with all of your heart. If there is something you want to do, go for it and don't stop until you make it happen. If there is something you want to be, do whatever is necessary in order to live out that dream. My greatest fear is that I'm going to have regrets about the way I have lived my life. When I was 21 years old, I found out that I had a family member I had never met. I desperately wanted to meet the person after I found out, but I could not get the courage to do so. After months and months of chickening out, I finally made plans to go and see the person on the following Monday. Unfortunately, he died the Sunday before I was supposed to go see him. I was absolutely devastated. All of the times I was too scared to go meet him came flooding back to me, and I was very hard on myself for not having had the guts to talk to him. At that moment, I realized that even though I never met the man, he taught me one of the greatest lessons of my life, and that is to live so that I won't regret my choices or decisions. That is one of the main reasons why I have lived my life the way I have. Before his death, I had always wanted to travel, but I was terrified to get on a plane. After the incident, however, I realized that I never wanted to regret anything again, and I started traveling extensively, living in London, backpacking across Europe, spending time in Japan. I am so thankful I did so. I know if I looked back on my life and I hadn't had my adventures and travels, I would have felt my life was only half lived. I tell my students that story, as well as others like it, because I want them to truly understand that they have got to make the most of their lives and not let anything stand in the way of their dreams. And I also tell them that whenever they're afraid to do something and when they feel fear in their hearts, that's when they know they are truly living and they need to face that fear because that is what life is about. Rule 52. Accept that you are going to make mistakes. Learn from them and move on. We are only human, and parents, teachers, and students alike will all do things they will regret. I made mistakes my first year of teaching, I made mistakes my 7th year of teaching, and I'm sure I'll make mistakes my 30th year of teaching. When it happens, you can't beat yourself up over it. You have to pick yourself up, learn from the experience, and move on. One of the biggest mistakes I have made as a teacher occurred during my very first year. As you might can imagine, I was a very animated teacher, and I was always trying to play music and get the kids involved in the lessons and in my classroom, and the teacher across the hall from me was very different. I taught 5th grade, she taught 4th grade, and she was just a very difficult person to get along with. She always looked like she had just swallowed a lemon. I mean, she was difficult, and she couldn't stand me. And she would always write these letters to the principal and to the superintendent, and she would say things like, "You need to fire him because he's trying to make education look too fun, and I think I saw in there one day he was playing music, and I think I saw him do that hoochie-coochie dance." And every time I turned around, she had written another letter, or I was having to go to another meeting, and we would sit in the office, me, Miss Bitterson, and the principal, and she would say, "And I'm tired of seeing what he's doing, and I'm tired of my 4th graders saying they can't wait to get in his class." And the principal would always say, "Well, you know, Miss Bitterson, his test scores are through the roof, he's doing an excellent job with those students, and I'm going to let him continue to teach the way he's teaching." And Miss Bitterson would always say, "I knew you were going to say that about him because he's your golden boy, he's your golden boy." That's why she called me. She would never call me by my name, Mr. Clark. She always called me Golden Boy. So anyway, I just did what I was told. The principal told me to shut my door and to ignore it. And it just kept getting worse and worse. It got to a point where sometimes my class would pass her class and she would say the rudest things to me and her class would always go, "Ooh," and my class would always look at me like, "Come on, Mr. Clark, get her." But I would never say anything. And one day I was in my classroom teaching and I had started a little tennis team with my students and I had left some of the tennis balls out on the field. And all of a sudden one of those tennis balls went flying into the classroom. And I said, "What is that?" And I looked at the door and there was Miss Bitterson and she said, "Go! You left one of your tennis balls out there on the field, and one of my kids could have tripped over it, and you could have had a lawsuit. How would you like that?" And her kids went, "Ooh." And my kids were looking at me like, "Come on, Mr. Clark, get her. Come on, Mr. Clark." So I said, well, Miss Bitterson, you just threw that ball in my classroom and you could have hit one of my kids in the head and you could have had a lawsuit. How would you like that? And my kids were like, ooh, and they just couldn't even hold it in any longer. They were so excited to finally get to say something to her. And so I didn't know what to do, but I knew I had to stop it. So I went and I just closed the door like I had been told to do. The principal said, Mr. Clark, just close the door and ignore it. So I closed the door. And I went on to teaching, and then later that afternoon, there was a knock at the door. And I said, hold on 1 second, kids, let me grab the door. And when I opened it, no one was there. And the kids started going, Mr. Clark, look, look. And I looked down, and there was a big green present sitting at the foot of the door. And I said, oh, kids, someone's giving us a present. It was big and green with all these bows and streamers. And I took the present, and I set it down on Tomias's desk. And I said, well, let's open it and see what it is. And when I opened it, all these slugs and worms and moths fell out. And Tomias went, phong, he went crawling down the aisle. And I was like, what is this? And I realized that Miss Bitterson had all of these creatures in her room, and she would come up to me sometime with a slug in her hand and go, how do you like this, golden boy? Take a look at this. Because she knew I didn't like all that stuff, and she was taunting me with it. And all of a sudden, I heard all of this laughter come from across the hall, and I realized she had done it as a joke to get me and to get my students, and that her class was really having a good time laughing about it. And my kids said to me, oh, Mr. Clark, we ain't going out like that, are we? We ain't going out like that. And I said to them, nope, we ain't going out like that. And the next day, we were doing this project with onions, and I had cut an onion open, and we were counting the rings and talking about onions, and I said, you know what, kids? I think I've got an idea. I said, but you can't tell anyone. And they promised they wouldn't. And I said, I need some lookouts. And Miss Bitterson's class was in the cafeteria. So I had all these kids go down the hall to be lookouts. And I acted like I was James Bond. And I put two pieces of the onion behind me. And I slid down the wall. And I looked to the left. And I looked to the right. And I looked to the left. Then I jumped on the floor. And I rolled over and over and over across the hall. Then I jumped up and I got in her room. And then I flew down the side of the room toward her desk, and I went around the desk, and I pulled up in the drawer, and I put those two pieces of onion all the way at the back of the drawer. Then I shut it, and I ran all the way across the hall and ran into the room and shut the door. And we laughed, and we laughed, and I said, now, kids, you have to promise that you won't tell anybody. And they promised. And you know what? They kept that promise, because 3 weeks later, no one had said anything about that onion. And I looked over in Miss Bitterson's room, and she was spraying her strawberry mist bottle all around her desk because she loved her strawberry mist bottle. She was always spraying it. And I thought to myself, she smells that onion, but she can't find it. And so I went over there and I said, excuse me, Miss Bitterson, what are you doing? And she said, something in here stinks and I can't find it. And she had this big cotton plant over her desk. And I said, I think it's your cotton plant. And she loved that cotton plant so much. And she said, golden boy, that cotton plant don't stink. Cotton plants don't stink. You don't know what you're talking about. And I said, oh, I said, well, I think it's your cotton plant. And I went over to my room. And later that day, I saw her taking that cotton plant out to the dumpster. And I thought it was so funny. But it got serious very quickly when I went out to my car that afternoon because, bless her heart, she had found that onion and she smeared it all over my front window, the side windows, the hood, and I said, no, she didn't. So I took those pieces of the onion and I went to the car wash and washed my car and I took the onion pieces home and I thought and I thought and I thought and finally I had it. And I took the pieces of onion and I put them in the blender. And I made them into a juice, and the next morning at 6:30, I got to the school with the custodian, Dwight Maddox. He let me in, and I went in Miss Bitterson's room with that juice, and I got a hold of her strawberry mist bottle. And I took it over to the sink, and I opened it up, and I poured out half of it. And then I poured the onion juice into the remaining portion of the bottle. Then I sprayed it all over her room and set it back on her desk and ran to my room. And that morning I washed, and when Miss Bitterson walked in her room, she stopped abruptly, and she looked to the left, and she looked to the right, and I could tell she could smell the onion, and she started looking frantically. She was pulling up desks and turning over books and pulling out cabinets. She wanted to find that onion before her students got there, but she couldn't. And then the students came in, and all morning I kept looking over there because all they did all that time was turn over desks, pull out bookcases. She had every kid in there hunting for that onion. And all the while, she was just standing in the middle spraying that strawberry mist bottle with all her might. And then a really wise teacher at the school named Miss Surface pulled me in and said she wanted to have a talk with me. And I said, "What is it?" And she said, "Mr. Clark, I heard what you did with Miss Bitterson and the onion, and I want you to know I'm really disappointed in you." I said, "What? Disappointed? Didn't you hear? I put the onion juice in the strawberry mist bottle. Isn't that classic?" And she said, "No, I don't think it's classic. I think it's horrible." She said, "Everyone has a reason for the way they act. And Miss Bitterson is the type person she is and the type teacher she is because of things that have happened to her throughout her life." And she told me some of the things that Miss Bitterson has been through, and I realized why she treated the kids the way she treated them and why she treated the other teachers the way she treated them as well. And I felt horrible. Miss Surface said that one of the reasons Mrs. Bitterson did not like me was because she wanted to teach just like me, but she didn't know how. Also, Mrs. Bitterson wanted the kids to like her, just as we all do, but she didn't know how to make that happen. And Ms. Surface said, "You know, instead of making a bad situation better, you made it worse." She said, "You could have went over there. You could have found a way to work with Ms. Bitterson. You could have found a way to make her become a better teacher and teach her how to relate to the kids better. But instead, you made it worse." She said, "There's so much hostility surrounding you and her class." She said, "The other day, Tamias, which was one of my students, was running down the hall, and Ms. Bitterson went to stop him, and she said, 'Tamias, you stop running.' And Tamias just laughed and kept on running." Ms. Surface told me that Tamias didn't respect Ms. Bitterson because I didn't respect Ms. Bitterson. Ms. Surface really opened my eyes, and I realized there was a lot of things I could have done to make that experience with Ms. Bitterson a positive one. I could have teamed up with Ms. Bitterson to do a science project with both of our classes. I will openly admit that science is my worst subject, and I sure could have used the help. I mean, I also could have gone to Ms. Bitterson for help with things that I usually asked other teachers about, because I think the number one compliment you can give anyone is to ask for help. So I could have done that. That could have helped better the relationship that I had with her. I could have made her feel like she was needed. I could have respected her. Instead, I made a bad situation worse, but I learned from my mistakes. And hopefully, maybe some of you can learn from my mistakes as well. No matter what school you teach in or where you work, there will probably be difficult people to get along with. But you have to remember, especially when kids are involved, that kids can tell. Kids are very smart, kids are very clever, and if there's hostility or hatred in the air, they will know it. And so for their sake, do whatever you have to get along and to make the environment that they live in and that they're learning in a positive one. Making mistakes are part of life, and no matter how old or experienced we are, they will still happen. One thing for sure is that with experience, there are far fewer mistakes. The longer I teach, the fewer errors I make, and as the years pass, when I do make a slip up, I am much more equipped to handle it. Mistakes will happen. Accept it and learn from them. Rule 53. No matter what the circumstances, always be honest. Even if you have done something wrong, it is best to admit it to me because I will respect that, and oftentimes I will forget any disciplinary measures because of your honesty. Honesty. It is the key to having a successful year in my classroom. On the first day of school, I spent a lot of time explaining to the kids that sometimes it is worth getting in a little trouble by telling the truth so you can have an easy conscience. I tell them that it is far more important to tell the truth because then they will be respected and trusted, and those two qualities can go a very long way. I always make a point to reward honesty. Sometimes I will have students do things that make me want to discipline them, but I won't, because they were honest about what they did. In my eyes, that is a far greater lesson to learn. Rule 54. Carpe diem. Seize the day. You only live today once, so don't waste it. Life is made up of special moments, many of which happen when caution is thrown to the wind and people take action and really seize the day. This rule sounds very similar to Rule 51, but they are really two very different things in my eyes and deserve to be separate lessons. Rule 51 is about living the life you want to lead. This rule, carpe diem, is about living each day to the fullest and appreciating each moment. My students must hear this 1,000 times a year. It is a part of who I am as a teacher and a person. It is the way I live my life, and it is my wish for my students that they can learn how important it is to make the most of each and every day of their lives. I recently took a group of 9 students from Harlem to North Carolina for a week. I just packed them in a van and we took off for a trip that I know changed their lives forever. Before we left New York, I said to the kids, "We are going to make the most of this week. We are going to live each day to the fullest, and anything you get the chance to do in North Carolina, I want you to do it. Even if it is new or different or scary, I want you to go for it." I had them make a pact with me during that week. We would all live up to the carpe diem philosophy. And during that week, they didn't let me down. Kids who were afraid of heights were climbing rock walls. Kids who had never been in water were learning to water ski. And kids who had never eaten pig at a hog cooking were asking if they could eat the tongue. And they did. It was a wild week of adventure, fun, and new experiences. We finished off the week at an amusement park. Now, I do not like roller coasters. They scare me to death. And I was going to break the pact because of my fear. Can you believe it? I was going to be the one to let the group down and not live up to my own advice. I couldn't help it. I was just so terrified. Then one of my students looked at me and quoted a line I had said to him many times before, "Mr. Clark, you better get busy living or get busy dying." My own words back in my face, and they worked. I found myself with the kids at my side, getting on each and every ride. I had never really enjoyed amusement parks before that day, but because I abandoned all fear and got busy living, I loved every minute of it. I was living. That week, we were all living. How wonderful it would be to live an entire life with such freedom to try new things, experience the unknown, and face our fears. It is hard for many adults to step out there and take those chances, but kids are more willing to release their inhibitions and truly live life. If we can teach them to embrace that feeling when they are young, hopefully it will stay with them for the rest of their lives. And finally, Rule 55. Be the best person you can be. Throughout life, you are going to be lonely at times. You are going to have your heart broken on occasion, and you are going to feel as if something is missing from your life. No life is lived without some amount of pain and heartache. No matter how bad things get, however, make sure you are always developing into the kind of person you want to be and the kind of person others will want to be around. It is important not to let external factors keep you from developing who you are and the person you are trying to become. Always make sure there are 7 things in your life at all times: laughter, family, adventure, good food, challenge, change, and the quest for knowledge. With all of those things, you will grow, enjoy life, and become the type of person you can be proud of. You will also be in a better position to help others, give advice, and learn from your mistakes because you will be a stronger, healthier, and happier person. A few tips for dealing with children. Working with kids is nerve-wracking. No matter how much practice or experience you have, there will always be worries and the fear that you will do something wrong. That is understandable because there is no responsibility greater than raising children. Whether you are a parent, a teacher, a counselor, or a member of the community, you face the task of setting a positive example for children, motivating them to succeed, and making a difference in their lives. During my years of working with students and all we went through together, I learned a lot about what makes kids tick and what methods are best when it comes to handling different situations. One thing I know for certain is that when you work with kids, you have to be clever. Overall, there are 4 universal truths I have gathered about kids. First, kids need and like structure. Students like to feel they are safe and that there is a figure of authority in control. I have seen teachers, as well as parents, make the mistake of being too lenient in order to win the affection of children. First-year teachers have said to me that they don't want to be too strict because they want the students to like them. In the beginning, I think students do like those teachers, but in the end, they have no respect for them. The best result is to have students who like you and respect you. In order to do that, you have to create structure in the classroom, you have to have clear, defined rules, and you have to make the students feel safe and comfortable. Second, kids will work hard for you if they like who you are as a person. Having a good discipline program will garner respect, but you may still have kids who do not particularly like you. Getting kids to like you can be quite a task. During the summer, before I ever meet my new class of students, I send them letters so that they will already know about me and my personality before the first day of school. I make sure to include lots of pictures in the letter that show I like to have fun and do exciting things. On the first day of school, I give the kids a brief slideshow of pictures of me and places I have traveled. I also have slides that show me when I was their age. I want the kids to immediately make a connection to me. I want them to see I am real and more than just their teacher. Third, kids like to know what is expected of them. It's unrealistic to expect kids to automatically behave exactly as you hope they will. Kids are kids, and many actions that may seem like common sense to us will seem foreign to them. I have found that no matter who the child is, if you explain exactly what you want from him and exactly how you hope he will act, then he will try his best to perform up to your standards. And finally, kids like to know they are cared for. In my first year of teaching, there was a child named Raymond who was a very disrespectful and disruptive child. In the classroom, he was a leader to the other students, and the chaos he created affected the climate of the entire class. I knew if I could find a way to reach him, that it would go a long way in terms of helping to control the entire class. One Friday afternoon, Raymond told me in a very cocky tone that he wasn't going to complete his weekend homework because he had basketball games to play on Saturday and Sunday in the recreation league. And so I said, "Oh, yes, you are going to complete your homework. You have to." And he said, "Oh, no, I'm not, and none of us are. Right, class? None of us are going to do that homework, are we?" They're like, "Right, none of us are going to do it." And I was like, "No," because I was losing all control of the entire class just because of that one catalyst. So what I did on that Saturday is I found out where the games were going to be played, and I attended the games. When Raymond saw me, he was shocked, and he walked up to me. He said, "Mr. Clark, what are you doing here?" I said, "Oh, Raymond, well, I came to watch you play this basketball game." He said, "You came to watch me?" I said, "Yes, Raymond." I said, "I figured if this game is more important than homework, then I needed to come check it out and find out what was going on here." He said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." And so he went to play the game, and the entire game, every time he would dribble the ball, he would look to see if I was watching. And every time he would shoot, he would look to see if I was watching. He kept his eyes on me the entire time, and I could tell it meant a lot to him that I was there. I looked around because I wanted to find his parents and talk to them, but they weren't there. And that told me a lot. That morning when Raymond came in, he had all of his homework completed, neat, and correct. In fact, Raymond turned into a model student. He became respectful and hardworking, and he no longer was a source of negative leadership. On the contrary, he became a positive role model for the rest of the class. The previous year, he had scored better than only 16% of all fourth graders in the state on the end of grade reading test. At the end of the fifth grade year, he scored better than 68% of all fifth graders. That improvement came simply because I showed him that I cared for him, and that sparked him to perform. It seems simple, and it is. Kids want to know you care for them. Before they are willing to invest effort in what you are saying, they want to know you are willing to make an investment in them. Once you have done that, dealing with kids is a much easier, more productive, and more meaningful experience. In closing, When I finished writing the book this program is based on, I was one happy person. Getting so many thoughts, ideas, and stories on paper was much harder than I first anticipated, and I thought I was finally done when my best friend Amanda asked me, "So, how does your book end?" I took a deep breath and gulped. Her statement scared the death out of me. How am I supposed to end this? As I tried to decide on an ending, I was talking with my co-teacher from Snowden Elementary School, Barbara Jones, and she said to me, "So, Mr. Clark, please tell me you wrote in the book what your meaning of life is. I'd love to hear you talk about it." I hadn't mentioned it up to that point, and it seemed like a fitting ending. So here goes. To me, life is all about experiences, the ones you make for yourself and the ones you make for others. As a teacher and as a person, I have tried to give special moments to people. Moments like that occurred when I announced to the students that they were going to the White House, surprised the students in Harlem with a trip to Los Angeles, had my students in the front rows of Phantom of the Opera, and every time I put my students in situations where they felt totally alive and knew that they were truly living. I remember one time I took a group of students to a Carolina basketball practice, and in North Carolina, basketball is king, and all of the students were Tar Heel fans. And I took the students, telling them that we were only going to get to watch a practice. What I didn't tell them is that they were really going to get to play a game in the Dean Dome and shoot around with some of the Carolina basketball players. After the practice, all of the kids came down and got autographs, and we were the only ones in the entire Dean Dome with the players. And I turned and I looked at the kids and I said, "Kids, I know you've got your bags up there and they have a change of clothes. And actually, I think you need to go ahead and change now, because kids, you're going to play a basketball game in the Dean Dome." And those kids went crazy, jumping up and down, screaming, the looks on their face. And there was one kid, Kenneth Adams, who I can't imagine seeing anyone happier in my entire life. Just the look on his face, he just glowed, and he was so happy. That moment had touched him, and I know he will never forget that moment for the rest of his life. It's moments like that that when you can create for students or people around you, to me, that's what life is all about. If this program has done nothing else, I hope it has inspired you to make more of a difference in the lives of children. Guide them as they grow, show them in every way possible that they are cared for, and make special moments for them that will add magic to their lives, motivate them to make a difference in the lives of others, and, most important, teach them to love life.
This has been a Hyperion Audiobooks production of The Essential 55, an award-winning educator's rules for discovering the successful student in every child. Written and read by Ron Clark. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Dennis Kehoe. Post-production by Kirk Miller Digital. The Essential 55 is also available in hardcover from Hyperion.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.